chapter 20. In our series through Matthew, this is now message number 50, entitled The Blind and the Seeing. And we're going to look at the rest of chapter 20, so that's going to be verses 17 to 34. And I'm going to read verses 17 through 19 as we start. And Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples apart in the way and said unto them, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him, and the third day he shall rise again. Well, the meeting with the rich young ruler, beginning back in chapter 19 and verse number 16, led to a sequence of events that ended with a parable at the beginning of chapter number 20. And the theme of this sequence of events was rewards in the kingdom, and particularly rewards beyond eternal life for those, of course, who enter the kingdom, as that entering and that eternal life being used in parallel. Well, the interaction with the rich young ruler brought this contrast between this present age and its rewards with the age to come and rewards in the messianic kingdom to the foreground. So the rich young ruler would have treasure in heaven, Jesus said, if he forsook everything now and followed him. Well, the 12 disciples had forsaken everything now, and so they wondered what their rewards would be. Well, Jesus gave them a direct and a specific answer to the apostles about what they would receive. In fact, that they would sit on 12 thrones, judging or ruling over the 12 tribes of Israel in the kingdom, in the regeneration, the restoration of all things. And he went on to emphasize that everyone who enters the kingdom inherits eternal life and will be rewarded. Everyone. Now, that's broader than just the 12, and even broader than just Israel, in fact, but it's not very specific in terms of what he had just told the 12 apostles. Well, Jesus illustrated rewards in the kingdom with a parable. Matthew is the only writer that includes this particular parable. And the parable, we saw how that it's consistent with the other kingdom parables. And it emphasizes the right and the righteousness of the landowner to give his rewards to whom he wills. And this actually has connection with what follows, as we'll see here tonight in this passage. Ultimately, rewards are not about the math. It's not about how much this person or how long they've done this or that or this work being greater than that and such, so that if we could just find the formula, we might be able to calculate our rewards in the kingdom. Well, certainly it's not about math. It doesn't work that way. And rewards in the kingdom are also not about gaining rewards the way that the world gains rewards in this present age. And so rewards and the kingdom will continue thematically in what follows and what we're looking at here, particularly in the rest of chapter number 20. So verses 17 to 34, which is the last part of this chapter, give us a series of three events. And this series of three events actually wraps up the Perea and Judea region ministry before Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. Now, what this means, on the one hand, is that Passover is near, and which this will be Jesus' last Passover. And that also means that as Passover is near, that crowds of people are on their way to Jerusalem. and the number of people in and around Jerusalem is rapidly increasing. And Jesus and his apostles are on the way to Jerusalem as well. Well, talk of rewards in the kingdom and Jesus' specific promise to the apostles actually leads to a play for power on the part of two of them in one of these events. So we want to look at this. There are three events here. We have in verses 17 to 19 where Jesus gives his 12 disciples a crucifixion prediction. In verses 20 to 28, we read about the two sons and the two sides of Jesus in the kingdom. And in verses 29 to 34, the two blind men on the way to Jerusalem. So let's start with this crucifixion prediction. Let's read verse number 17 again. And Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples apart in the way and said unto them. So Jesus is walking again toward Jerusalem, and we know that that's been his goal really since all the way back from the Mount of Transfiguration, which is all the way in the northern part of Israel territory. He's been working his way south and ultimately heading toward Jerusalem. He left Galilee. He's come into the area of Perea and of the region of Judea, and is continuing on and on, ever moving closer toward Jerusalem. Now, Matthew hasn't been drawing a lot of attention lately to the crowds, but we see them mentioned here and there, and we're kept aware of the fact that they're still around, and there's crowds of people that are following Jesus. Obviously, the crowds of travelers in general is going to be greater with the nearness of the Passover and the closer that they get to Jerusalem. Now, we have some sort of a time lapse. Verse 16 was the conclusion of the parable, and we don't know how much time, and probably not a lot of time, but there's some time lapse. There is some separation here, and we're told that Jesus now has taken the 12 apart from the crowds. He has separated them in order to speak to them privately, and he does so, and once again, Matthew is emphasizing Jesus' private ministry of instruction and preparation for his 12 apostles. Look at verse number 18. Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death. So Jesus gave the apostles the fourth prediction of his death in Matthew's gospel. The first prediction of his death actually occurred back in chapter 12 and verse number 40. So you're a pretty good way into Matthew's gospel, almost halfway before that prediction. You are certainly well in the second year of Jesus' ministry, oftentimes known as the Galilee ministry, before this prediction comes. It also comes after some key events of rejection on the part of Israel and the leaders of Israel. So this first occurs in chapter 12 and verse number 40, and it's something of a veiled reference because this was given in response to those that were seeking some sort of apocalyptic sign from Jesus, and he merely spoke there about the Son of Man being in the earth for 3 days and three nights, and that being the only sign given to that generation of Israel. Now, obviously, that was not widely understood when he spoke it. It was, again, something of a veiled reference, but we know that it was a reference to his resurrection. The second prediction comes in chapter 16 and in verse number 21. Now, in chapter 16, this follows Peter's confession. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. That key moment in Matthew's gospel and Mark's gospel as well, when Peter makes that confession, and we get sort of this turn toward Jerusalem. Well, after this confession, Jesus told his disciples that he would suffer, he would be killed, put to death, and that he would rise again the third day. The third prediction came in chapter 17, verses 22 to 23. Now, this is after the Transfiguration. And in that prediction, Jesus added to it that he would be betrayed and then killed and would rise again the third day. And now we've come to the fourth prediction that Jesus is giving of his crucifixion. And still yet, as we've noticed, every step along the way, as he's given a prediction, he has added something more to what he has told them. And in every one, there has been mention of his resurrection. So now this is the fourth prediction. He tells them here that he will be betrayed into the hands of the chief priests and the scribes. Now, these are obviously referring, he's already said, you know, we're going to Jerusalem, and he's going to be betrayed into their hands. So these are the leaders, these are the rulers, really, of Israel. I'm referring to the chief priests and scribes this way, and also the fact that they're going to condemn, they're going to pass a sentence on him, indicates that Jesus is talking about the Sanhedrin, which was the supreme court of Israel in that day, and that they're going to, he's going to be betrayed and handed over to them, and they're going to pass a sentence on him, a sentence of death. They will judge him worthy of execution. And of course, Israel in that day had quite a bit of independence and freedom in governance of Israel, particularly when it relates to matters of their law and religion and such. But they didn't have the authority to execute someone legally. So condemning him to death has been the plan of the Jewish leaders for some time by this point. And Jesus is telling them they're going to carry this out. Verse number 19. And shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him, and the third day he shall rise again. So Jesus tells his disciples, we're going up to Jerusalem, going to be betrayed and handed over. The Sanhedrin is going to condemn me to death, and they're going to deliver him to the Gentiles. Now the word that's used here, ethnos in the Greek, it means nations. It's equivalent to the goyim in the Hebrew. And obviously he's talking about the Romans at this point, the Roman Empire, which was ultimately over Israel at this time. But notice how that Jesus adds here that he's going to be handed over and he's going to be mocked, he's going to be scourged, and he's going to be crucified. Again, very specific prophecies that he is given concerning what's about to happen to him. And the word for crucify is just that, to be affixed to a stake. It is exactly what Jesus is saying. Now, Jesus also here again predicts that he would rise from the dead after 3 days. Now, at this point, Matthew doesn't give any response or any reaction. You remember when after the confession, you know, Peter tried to resist this prediction. No, this is not going to happen. Far be it from you. Jesus rebuked him. After the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus gave this prediction about his death, and Matthew just told us that the disciples were just very grieved. And he doesn't really give us any response or effect on the disciples here. But in Luke's account, which is parallel at this point, Luke points out that the disciples did not understand all of this. Now, we'll see that in Matthew as well a little further along. But Luke makes that point. Luke, I think it's chapter 18, verse number 34. And in fact, he states there that not only did they didn't understand it, so they didn't put all these things together. They couldn't connect all these things together to some sort of an intelligible meaning. And in fact, he says it was hidden from them. So at least at this time, before their eyes were open to it, Jesus is talking about all of these things with his death, mystery of the kingdom, all these sort of things, and they have not put this all together in their minds at this point. And in fact, I think it's in John's gospel. In fact, he makes reference to the fact that it wasn't until after Jesus was glorified that they understood what all these things meant and how that they went together. Verse number 20 starts the next event, and this is where we have the two sons and the two sides of Jesus in the kingdom. Verse number 20. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. Right, so Jesus is still on the way to Jerusalem, and now the mother of James and John come to Jesus with her sons with a request. Worshiping him means she's bowing, she's bowing before him. She has a request for him. Now, Mark has this account as well, and Mark does not mention their mother being there. He puts it that James and John came with this request to Jesus. Matthew has the mother with them, and the mother is ultimately making the request, though James and John do speak here. So when we read these together, it seems then that the point is that the mother did come, but it's the instigation of James and John. Ultimately, they're behind this request being made to Jesus. So obviously that also tells us that they had told their mother about Jesus' promise that they would sit on thrones over Israel in his kingdom. And so now they're taking that promise and they're saying, well, if we're going to be sitting on thrones, if 12 of us are going to be sitting on 12 thrones over Israel, then you know what? We better have the seats on the left and the right of Jesus, because that would be the highest position. Verse 21, he said unto her, what wilt thou? She saith unto him, grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on thy left, in thy kingdom. So she asked Jesus, this is the request, that James and John, one be sat on the right seat of Jesus' throne, and one be set on the left seat of Jesus' throne in his kingdom, which, again, would be the highest position in the kingdom. It would be second only to Jesus the King. It would be to be the greatest in heaven among those apostles. Now, Jesus responds here in verse 22, but Jesus answered and said, you know not what you ask. Are you able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They say unto him, we are able. So Jesus responds ultimately to her and to the two sons that you don't understand what you're asking for. Now, obviously, we've seen the argument among the disciples has been going on and continues to go on and will continue to go on even to the very night that Jesus is betrayed and arrested. They're going to be continuing to be arguing about that and seeking greater position one over the other. And so it seems like they've taken Jesus' promise and sort of have turned that into, well, okay, if we're all going to have thrones, then we need to get the highest thrones. We need to get the thrones that are higher than the others. So Jesus refers to drinking the cup and being baptized. And these are not references to baptism and the Lord's Supper. These are figurative references to experiencing tremendous suffering. Sometimes people, even in our language, you'll hear sometimes somebody say something about a baptism of fire. They'll be talking about some very strenuous or very difficult experience or harrowing experience, whatever that it may be. Well, drinking of the cup and being baptized with this baptism here, in Jesus' case in particular, is specifically talking about suffering the wrath of God. And he's asking them, are you able to do this? And of course, they don't understand what they are asking for. So clearly, Jesus' point as he starts talking about this cup and this baptism that's before him, they did not understand the path to high place in the kingdom. And we'll see a little later on in Matthew that Jesus really did suffer. He really did suffer. And much of his suffering, I believe, is incomprehensible to us. But he really did suffer. I think maybe sometimes people have the thing, well, you know, he was God, so it wasn't really that big of a deal kind of a thing. No, it was suffering that we would never be able to measure, certainly never be able to endure ourselves. He really did suffer. So as he talks about this cup and this baptism that's before him, this is not a hypothetical. This is not something just sort of theoretical. This is the path. And he's saying, do you understand? Can you walk this path that I am going to walk? Well, James and John responded, yes, we're able. Probably indicating, you know, we're willing, we're ready. Now, even though they had not understood to this point what Jesus meant by the predictions of his execution, they said, yeah, we're ready. Sign us up. Then verse 23, and he saith unto them, ye shall drink indeed of my cup and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. So Jesus acknowledges that they are indeed going to drink his cup and they are going to experience his baptism of suffering. Of course, we know that James went on not too awful long after this time to be beheaded at the order of Herod Agrippa I. That's in Acts chapter 12 and verse number 2. John would go on to live quite a long life, but he would experience immense suffering for the name of Christ. Both of them would, and that's obviously what Jesus is talking about here, though none of this has happened to either of them at this point. And Jesus also explained to them something else that they did not understand. That the seats on his right hand and his left hand are not his to give to anyone other than those for whom God prepared them. The use of this term prepared occurs a little bit later, chapter 25 and verse 34, in the sense of God preparing something, and it is before the foundation of the world. So Jesus is talking about the will and the purpose of God, something that is in existence or is settled before the world's ever even created. Again, they don't understand what they're asking for. Jesus says, this is not mine to just give to anyone because they ask or because they've done this or because they've done that, but rather it is only for those for whom God has prepared it. And that isn't that somewhat ironic that just after Jesus has told them this parable about the rewards in the kingdom being given by God's will and that human merit or accomplishment or request is not the way of gaining rewards, that he's right in doing what he will with his own, and then they're asking essentially for that to be changed at this point. Of course, they don't understand what they're saying. We are nowhere told, that I'm aware of, who those seats are prepared for. And I'm sure someone would like to ask. And I've not even read any decent ideas about who that these may be prepared for. I'm sure that there are some that have ideas, because there always are. But there's nothing that I'm aware of in the Bible that tells us who these seats are prepared for. Now, we can go to the Bible and we can find two people mentioned here or two people mentioned there, but there's nothing that would connect them with what Jesus is saying here. So, far as I understand, That has not been revealed, though we will find it out for certain one day. Verse 24. And when the ten heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brethren. So the ten, and which is a reference to the rest of the apostles, the two and the ten make 12, they were very displeased with James and John. And again, there's this continuing argument among them about which one of them would be the greatest. And now these two have simply stepped forward to request those positions. Now you recall they were arguing about that earlier back in at the beginning of chapter 18. And they simply asked Jesus, who would be the greatest. And now we have two that have actually just simply stepped forward and are requesting those positions. And again, perhaps they were feeling somewhat emboldened because Jesus had promised them thrones over Israel in that kingdom. Verse 25, but Jesus called them unto him and said, ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. So he gathered the apostles together to address this issue. And he tells them that the greatest in the nations, when you look out at the nations of the world, those that are the greatest in those nations are those who have the most power. It is still the same way today. And those who have the most power are those who govern and rule over other people. And they do so for their own benefit and purposes. In this present world, there's no greater place or power than to be over others. Let me look at verse 26 and 27 here. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. So whoever would be great in the age to come, Jesus says, will be a servant in this age, and not the other way around. The word for minister that he uses here, the diakonos, which is a table waiter. It was the most menial position of service. The word for servant is the doulos, which refers to a bond slave, which isn't even on the level of a diakonos. It's even lower. It's the lowest of the low, really, that you can get. So essentially what Jesus is giving them here is the very same message of humility that he gave them earlier. If you want to be great in the kingdom, if you want to be great in that age to come, then you must be the servant of all now. You must be the least of all now in this age. In other words, you might say that coming to great position or great power in this present age doesn't translate or correlate into being in a position of great power in the age to come. And notice verse 28. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. So Jesus points now to his own example. And amongst the apostles, they all believed Jesus to be the Messiah. We know Judas Iscariot had his problems, but they believed Jesus to be the Messiah, believed him to be the Son of David. Peter makes this confession, you're the Christ, you're the anointed. You are the Son of the living God is who you are. So they know that Jesus is greatest. In other words, they don't have ambition that they're going to be greater than him. They know that Jesus is greatest. And so Jesus is actually appealing to that as he says, even as the Son of Man. And again, that title, which is so rich, it's so filled with meaning. And you go back to the connection, he is the one who receives the kingdom from the Ancient of Days on his throne in heaven. And then he rules over Israel and over the nations of the world forever. That's the Son of Man. He says, even the Son of Man came. And he's talking about came into this present age, came into this world here and now. He came, he said, not to be served, not to minions that are sort of fawning over him and fulfilling his request, but to serve. He didn't come to the earth to fight and claw his way to the top so that he could have a kingdom. He came, he says, rather, not only to be a servant, but to be the ultimate servant and to give his life a ransom for many. And it's a very interesting choice of words to speak of giving his life as a ransom, giving how close that they are to the Passover. And ransom was one of the ways that the Exodus of Egypt is characterized in the Old Testament. Ransom referred primarily to paying the ransom price to free a slave. And God ransomed Israel from slavery in Egypt. And now Jesus says, again, coming up near to the Passover, that he came to give his life a ransom for many. Well, this could be considered another death prediction, as it adds the substitutionary atonement aspect of his execution, his life given for the life of many. And then we get the last event that begins here in verse 29 and the two blind men on the way to Jerusalem. Verse 29, and as they departed from Jericho, a great multitude followed them. So again, they're continuing toward Jerusalem. They're leaving Jericho. Matthew makes note of the crowds following them still. Verse 30, and behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside, when they heard that Jesus passed by, cried out, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. So two blind men sat by the road. They heard that Jesus was passing by. So they cried out to him. What did they ask for? Well, they didn't ask for a promotion. They didn't ask for great seats in his kingdom. They didn't ask for what they deserved. They didn't even ask for special favor. They asked for mercy. Have mercy on us. Take pity on us. Have compassion toward us. And of course, they addressed Jesus as the Son of David. It's a messianic title emphasized particularly by Matthew. Of course, that foreshadows what's about to happen in Jerusalem as well. Verse 31, and the multitude rebuked them, because they should hold their peace, but they cried the more, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. So those in the crowd told them to be still, not the disciples hushing them, but the crowds that are following Jesus. And this only prompted them to be more earnest in crying out for mercy from the Son of David. Verse 32 says, and Jesus stood still and called them and said, what will ye that I shall do unto you? So he did stop along the way, asked them what they wanted, and notice their request, verse 33, and they say unto him, Lord, that our eyes may be opened. So they requested that their eyes be opened, using language as that was prophesied of the Messiah in places like Isaiah chapter 35 and verse number 5, that he would open the eyes of the blind. And they're certainly acknowledging that he is the Son of David. He is that Messiah. Verse 34 says, so Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight and they followed him. So Matthew notes that Jesus acted, and he acted with compassion toward them. He took pity on them. He showed mercy to them. He touched their eyes, and they were immediately healed. And then Matthew adds that they followed after Jesus. So the Perean and Judean region ministry began back in chapter 19 and verse 1. And it began with these crowds following Jesus and Jesus healing those crowds. And here it ends with a healing and the mass crowd trying to stop it. Foreshadowing, of course, the rejection that is about to occur. Well, the disciples didn't understand all that Jesus told them. And clearly, they thought they were going to Jerusalem and the kingdom was soon to come. And that's why that we see sort of this escalation in this conflict and contention between them about who would be the greatest, even to the point that James and John are going to step forward and just simply request those highest positions at the right and the left hand of Jesus. And it seems that it spurred them to thinking about where they would be in the kingdom, trying to secure the highest place, because they think it is just about to come. Well, Jesus responded to James and to John much in line with that parable that he had just given about the fact that rewards were given by the grace and the will of God. They can't simply be requested. They are given, and they're given by God's determination. They're given by His will and His purpose. And they're given, again, according to His grace. They're gracious gifts that are given. Well, the message about this age is certainly clear. It's not position and power in this age that correlates to position and power in the age to come. And Jesus repeated here once again that the greatest then would truly be the least now, and offers Himself as the primary example of that path.